Good afternoon, brethren. We had a slight moment of confusion. I thought we were going to have another song. Some of us need more than one bit added to our statue. I'd like to make a few comments about the feast. I think this is perhaps one of the most enjoyable, fun-loving, peaceful, harmonious feasts that I can remember. I'd like to thank my fellow elders because the topics that they've chosen we seem to have merged and blended in very well, giving a wonderful background to the world tomorrow and the messages. And also for the singing. I've noticed how well everyone sings out loud, and there's just heart and feeling in the singing is what I feel. Of course, the children's choir, except for the war over the microphone, just about over there between two little girls. One who loved a microphone. Can I sing closer, please? And then you see a little bit of human nature come out. Just beautiful. Just beautiful. Just like to encourage us to remember those who are suffering. We have a couple of people who we're aware of, and I won't mention any names, but we're aware they're suffering at this time. Also, we have 10 Spanish brethren out in the hallway, and I didn't know we had 10 Spanish brethren here among our congregation, so I'll say buenos todos to them all. They're sitting out and the lady is translating. We found that out yesterday at the senior citizens luncheon, which I'm not qualified to be at. But I went anyway. And the family, the talented family, the son Duncan played the piano, he and his father and mother and so forth were there, and Zoe was there. She played a very nice little piece. Thank you, Zoe. And thank you all of you for the music there. And finally, just one little announcement for a moment here, and that is that this morning we had the wonderful opportunity to have a burial and a resurrection. Baptized a young lady down here and had a wonderful time. Her name is Bridget Moroney, and she is now a member of God's called out body of believers. So that's wonderful. Now I must write down the time to stop. If I don't do that, I'll lose it. It's 20 till, so I've got an hour. Okay, so it's 20 to 3, so that's 20 minutes to 4. Might not mean much, but I'll try. People often wonder what you're thinking about when you're standing up here at a moment like this. I'm thinking there's about 800 eyeballs looking at me. You may not know the individual named Reuben Carter. Reuben Carter was also known as Hurricane Carter. Hurricane Carter was a boxer. And he fell, he was well known for the speed at which he could move and punch. And he became accused of killing three people in a bar. Went through a trial, and this was in 1966, and in spite of multiple witnesses who testified that he wasn't there, he still was convicted. And he spent, he was sentenced to three lifetimes in prison. Can you imagine that? I cannot. He was released 19 years later. In 1985, there was a book written about him and a movie made of him, of his life story and what had happened. He made a very, very telling comment, and Hurricane Carter said this, and I quote, Prison is the lowest level of human existence you can exist on without being dead. Can you imagine that? Such a terrible, terrible place as prison. Now, we have an amendment which says in our Constitution for us Americans. Is there anyone here that's not American? No, everyone's American. You're not American. What's the matter with you? Be like me. Join the club. We have a constitutional point which says you should not have cruel or unusual punishment. And it seems to me that Hurricane Carter clearly describes cruel and unusual punishment. Then there's David Lee Wiggins. David Lee Wiggins was accused of raping a 14-year-old girl. There was no physical evidence that was presented at the scene of the crime of him being there. And his young victim picked him out of a lineup as the one who was guilty for the rape. He was imprisoned for life in 1989. And on August the 12th of this year, he was released. He was found to be innocent by DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid evidence. Now, how do you think that both of these men felt as a result of being unjustly judged and found guilty? Well, I think Hurricane Carter made an excellent point there when he said, you know, it's the lowest level of human existence you can be in order to be, rather than being dead, without being dead. But Hurricane Carter, remarkably, and both David Lee Wiggins from Texas, did not take on that attitude. And matter of fact, injustice is a common thing that happens in our criminal system. And sometimes you wonder if attorneys are there not to try and find out the truth. You know, they go from the absolute worst to the absolute best, you know, depending on your defense or your the prosecution. But 84 people were exonerated in the state of Texas alone since 1989 due to DNA evidence, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. I want you to ask yourself a question now. Can you think of times in your life when you've been treated unjustly? I can, and I'm sure you can too. And sometimes people are captivated by that period of time in their life. My next door neighbor in St. Petersburg, Florida, his name was Marty. And one day he and I were talking and he got very, very upset. Marty may be dead by now. He was in his 70s 10 years ago. And he got so annoyed, he was on the verge of tears as he spoke as to when he was a child. And they took his school cap off and threw it over a fence. Now, can you imagine carrying that hurt and pain all that time? Well, before we go much further about the topic, which is injustice and the purpose for injustice, if you will, let us ask the question, what is justice? You may not know, and you may not realize, but oftentimes we use words and we really don't know the meaning of those words. We don't know how they apply to something that is vague like justice. I'm going to mention two things, two areas of understanding. One is abstract and the other is concrete. Such terms as justice, be fair, be good, be nice, are abstracts. I, as a father, make the mistake with my children saying, now, be good. What do you mean? What constitutes good? What constitutes fair? It's an abstraction. And so when my children did something that I didn't like and I punished them for it, I was, in fact, being unjust. Now, if I had have told them don't smack your brother in the eye. That's a concrete thing. That's an action which they can understand, right? But with my ignorance, and I'm glad my children survived my parenting, we had the be good. Justice is an abstract term. President Obama and the Democratic Party, this is not a party political speech, use the term, everybody should pay their fair share of taxes. Have you heard that on advertisement? Yes, you have, I'm sure. Everyone should pay their fair share is an abstraction. What is fair? What is fair? 2% of this nation pays something like 80% of the taxes, and 49% of the people in this nation pay zero. Is that fair? But I think we ought to have the rich paying more because they've got their more. Is that fair? How do we define fair? Fair is whatever you want to make it. Justice is whatever you want to make it. Being nice is whatever you want to make it. Being good is whatever you want to make it, in your opinion. Let's go to the other side of the coin. What is concrete? Well, I gave my mother's funeral down in South Texas in May, and we have several members of the family who were brought up in God's way and have departed from it. And so I made a point. And my point was to them, and I didn't tell them it was for them, but it really was, because a funeral is for the living, not the dead. And I said to them, what is hard not to understand about don't lie? What is hard not to understand about don't steal? What is hard not to understand about don't kill or don't murder? What is hard about these concrete terms? God's way is not abstract. God's commandments are concrete, they're clear, they're not, as it were, discussable, and they don't change. I might reference, I won't take time to go there, but Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 11 through 18, says, what concourse has had righteousness with darkness, or idols with God's way? And he gives five or six concrete explanations in his own terms to the Corinthians about what is concrete, and it's very, very clear. Humanity without God is unjust. There's no question about it. If you'll turn to Habakkuk, please. The book of Habakkuk, and we can see this very, very clearly. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. Habakkuk. The burden which the prophet, in chapter 1, verse 1, the burden which the prophet Habakkuk saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you did not save. Why do you show me iniquity or lawlessness, and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me, there is strife and contention arises. Therefore, the law is powerless. And justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous, therefore perverse judgment proceeds. What a condemnation. This was written approximately 605 BC, just before Judah went into captivity by the Babylonians. Perverseness, violence, contention. And the prayer was to the Lord. And I want to just mention at this time our Sheila and Sheila and what's your sister's name? Faye, that's right, sorry. Sang a beautiful song. Now, I mentioned very briefly in my last sermon, and I'll mention it again here. When you look at the word Lord in the King James Version, it's a translation of the YHVH. And when they sang Hallelujah, Hallel is Hebrew for praise. The last five psalms are the Hallelujah Psalms. So praise ye Yah, the shortened singular version of Yahweh. So thank you very much, ladies. I neglected to do it earlier, and I apologize. Very, very good job. So we see this burden of God's people here that should have known differently with God's law, which is black and white. And it became perverted. The law became useless and powerless, and they just weren't doing it. Almost, let's go to the social prophet, Amos. That's going back towards the front. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, and verse 12. There are dozens and dozens of scriptures about justice. Do horses run on rocks? Is there anybody? I mean, I don't ride horses there. We don't agree. They know I can't ride, and so they do what they want to do. So I just don't do it. But does a horse run on rocks? No, it walks, doesn't it? And does one plow there with oxen? No, you don't, because a plow doesn't plow solid rock or rocks. Yet you have turned justice into gall, bitterness, if you will, and the fruit of righteousness into wormwood. So we have this abstraction of justice which has been turned into bitterness and gall. And even with God's laws, injustice prevails. Even with God's laws, injustice prevails. Matthew chapter 23 and verse 23. I'm going a little slower for the sake of the ladies translating out in the hallway for the Spanish brethren there. So I'll just explain that. Matthew chapter 23. This is the excoriation of the religious body politic of the day who sat in Moses' seat. And I love verse 8. But you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Messiah, and you are all brothers and sisters. We're brethren. Don't be as the Gentiles do, as it goes on further down. I think we have that spirit and heart a lot more in the church than we had in times past. Verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. A hypocrite is a person that says one thing and does another. Okay? That's clear. What were they doing wrong here? They had Torah. Torah are the teachings and instructions of God, normally known as the first five books of the Bible, and with their Greek names, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. The Hebrew names are much more meaningful. In Hebrew, Genesis is in the beginning, which is the first three words of the book. And that was the name of the scroll. So they are hypocrites. Why were these religious teachers that made judgments and determinations hypocrites? What made them hypocrites? Well, he said, you pay tithe in mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. Now, you can have the law, but if you neglect the weightier matters of it, then you become unjust. And the justice and mercy and faith were the weighty things that should be considered in God's law. And indeed, if you will, in man's law. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. So the scribes and Pharisees weren't very good people because they were hypocrites, because they were unmerciful, because they were not just. Turn with me to Luke chapter 11 and verse 42. Luke 11 verse 42. Woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe on mint and rue and all manner of herbs or herbs, and pass by justice and the love of God. So with God's law, we need God's love and as a result of that, we will have justice. These ought you to have done, but you did not do that. Verse 46. He said, woe to you also, you lawyers, for you load men with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers. It's easy to load people down with rules and regulations. Study the word Corban, and you will see that that covers that point. C-O-R-B-A-N. But they did not do anything to relieve the burdens of God's people. And let's see, verse 52. Woe to you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter in yourselves, and those who were entering in you hindered. How? Why? By making rules and regulations on top of the basic instructions of God, and were unjust and heavy-handed and burdensome on people, and therefore they became unjust. Now, there are many, many more examples I could bring to this, but I want to move on because we must move to the concrete foundation of what justice, the abstraction, is. In order to have a basis of justice, we must have a set standard. We call that set standard law. We have a choice. We have man's law and we have God's law. Now, in general terms, man rejected God in the beginning at the Garden of Eden. And so, as has been mentioned two or three times, not the least by myself also, that man departed from the world and the potential of the tree of life, and had the avenue of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So we have those two elements. I want to read something to you now which is very, very unusual. I'm not going to tell you who it was. I'd like you to try and think about the reasoning of this gentleman. At the end, I'll tell you who it was. This individual came to the conclusion that there is such a thing as a creator, and there is natural law. I'm going through this slowly because it's a logical progression of thought. There's a creator, there is a natural law. Therefore, right conduct, behavior if you will, is behaving in accordance to the natural law of the creator. Once we recognize the creator, the only intelligent approach to government, justice, human relations, is in the terms of law, which was applied God's natural law. To apply God's natural law. Therefore, those who share law must also share justice. Man has a mind. Animals have a limited mind, if you will. And God has given us a mind with which we can reason. And man's mind is intelligent and it does reason. And reason, when well developed, is wisdom. Therefore, those who share, number one, the Creator, number two, the Creator's laws, number three, right reasoning with our minds, those laws, and number four, the result will be right justice. He also went on to say, all of us human beings, wherever we come from in this world, whatever race or nationality we are God's creation. And therefore, we are part of a wonderful commonwealth of people who have mind, who have intelligence, and so forth. This indeed he called the first great commandment, which he said was love respect, and obey the all-wise Creator. And he went on to reason, the second great commandment, love your neighbor or your fellow man as you love yourself, was necessary. This individual's idea, the concept of love, an emotion, as a mighty social bond between any and everybody, that pointed towards God and Christ. Loving our fellow man means recognizing the principle of natural law. And justice is impossible without applying God's law with right reason. Now, I know that was rather long and I went through it slowly, but I think you can get the idea that this individual recognized and saw two of the great commandments, love your neighbor and love God. And it was the emotional love that bonded us together as human beings. All of God's people, no matter where on this earth, no matter who we are, what our color is, what our background is, all of us are God's people. That's why discrimination is such a terrible thing. So God is a creator. He created animals with a limited mind. He created humans in his image with intellect, the ability to reason. And without the right laws of God, we reason wrongly. With the right laws of God, which he exposed to humanity, his principles, his determination of what is right and wrong is the important thing. It's impossible for the unconverted to understand. Is it possible for the unconverted to understand the principle of a creator and natural law? It is. How many think it's impossible? Okay, I've got a couple of nodding heads in one hand. How many don't know? A couple of hands, brave people. Gotcha. Well, let me tell you who I just gave you the logical progression of reasoning. He was a gentleman called Marcus Tullius Cicero, a Roman, no less, educated in Athens under the great philosophers Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, became proconsul in Rome. Proconsul is the one right underneath Caesar. And in about 36 BC was slaughtered. It was this gentleman that our founding fathers in the United States were aware of and read. And you'll notice in the beginning of our Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. What did Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers say? We have unalienable rights and natural law. They got it from Cicero and Blackstone and I'm forgetting all of the philosophers, Locke and so forth. And they were well educated, not only in this, but also in what had happened in history. They were well aware of what Cicero thought and taught. And yet Cicero did not have the belief system of the Jewish people who were around at the time and was educated in a total alien environment of gods and demigods, Zeus being the greatest one, and all of the philosophies that flowed all in and out of that demiurge, as it was called. So I wonder, how did Cicero reach his conclusions? How did he come to this? Somehow he was able to, wend his way through all of these philosophies and ideas and recognize a creator God, first of all, and laws, secondly, and that justice could only exist when we had God's laws and love. It's an amazing story indeed. Now, am I saying he was converted? I don't know. That's not my call. I do know he left a record that should astound us when we realize that the carnal human mind can reason rightly. And how do we know whether or not God was working with him? And how do we know whether or not this was left as an inheritance to us to learn and grow by? God can use anyone he likes. No doubt Cicero was an intellectual Everest of the day. No doubt. He was obviously put to death before his time. But let's have a look at these natural laws that our founding fathers put in place and see how they apply to us today. Luke chapter 10, verse 25. You may still be in Luke. Luke 10, verse 25. Behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, Teacher or Rabbi, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Now notice what the response was. He said to him, what is written in the law? What is your reading of it? What is written in the teachings and instructions? Now, the law of Moses, as it might be called, or Torah, can also mean the five books, but it also can mean the whole body of teaching, and it can also mean specific laws. So when you read this law, what do you mean? What do you understand? And he said to him, verse 27 and 28, love God with all your might and love your neighbor as yourself. He said to him, verse 28, you have answered rightly. Do this and you will live. But he said, wanting to justify himself, he said to Jesus, well, who's my neighbor? Ha, ha, ha. Very smart. Who's my neighbor? Then we have the story of the Good Samaritan. The irony about the story of the Good Samaritan, which follows in the next few verses, is this. We don't know who the person beaten up on the road was. We know who the Samaritan was in the north of Israel, mixed in with the people that the Assyrians brought over when they took the leadership and many people from the land. They had a corrupted religion. We know who the Samaritan was, and they were hated and despised by the Jewish people. Who was the guy beaten up and stripped of his clothes on the road? I'm going to speculate and say, what if it was a good Jew? And along comes this despised Samaritan, verse 33, because the good Jew was left by a certain priest and a Levite who did not want to become ceremonially unclean, and so they left him there. A certain Samaritan, verse 33, as he journeyed, came where he was, and he saw him and had compassion. Compassion. And so we know the story, I hope, well enough. Bound him up, put him on his animal, took him, paid for the innkeeper to look after him. Anything left over, I'll pay you when I come back. And so the end of the conversation, verse 36. Which of these do you think was the neighbor to him who fell among thieves? And he said, he who showed mercy. He who showed mercy. And Jesus said to him, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. It was that incredible bond of loving, the emotional, the word emote means to spring forth from. That's where we get emoter, out away from. This is where we get this unquantifiable feeling called emotions that drive us to do one thing or the other. And so we see very clearly, as we have read here Luke chapter 10 rather, that the Good Samaritan did what he would have wanted someone to do to him if he were in that position. And likewise in our lives, putting ourselves, love-based, is putting ourselves in a position of others and acting accordingly. Do we want to be spoken to nicely? Do we want to be treated kindly? Do we want to have encouragement? Can we help? Love and compassion comes as a result of knowing how you want to be. And it does not matter how many laws or rules or regulations there are, you cannot proscribe compassion and love. It's an abstract. Let's turn to Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2. Now, this is the... it's Mark 12, not 2. Mark chapter 12. And we go through the similar story again. Begins in verse 28. Same question, which is the first commandment of all. This is the second giving of this parable. And we see in verse 33... verse 32. So the scribe said to him, "Well said, teacher, you have spoken the truth, for there is one God and there is no other but he. And to love him with all your heart and all your understanding and with all your soul and with all your strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than the whole of burnt offerings and sacrifices." Now, let's think a moment. They were in the middle of sacrificing. They were in the middle of it. Jesus had not been sacrificed yet. And yet this scribe admitted that to love your neighbor was more than all of burnt sacrifices and offerings. Did the religious body know that? Probably some did. You can't condemn all of humanity just because we've got a few examples of Jesus excoriating those people. But to love one's neighbor as you love yourself is the important point. So when Jesus saw that, he answered him wisely. He said to them, "You're not far from the kingdom of God." So can we conceptualize now that this love neighbor is a general overall abstraction which can only be interpreted in the light of God's law? Otherwise, where did he get the understanding from to love one's neighbor as yourself, to love God with all your heart and with all your understanding and with all your soul? Well, I'll tell you where he got it from: the book of Moses, the five books of Moses, in fact, the fifth book of Moses. But let's first of all examine loving your neighbor. Chapter 19 of Leviticus. And verse 9. "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest." Leviticus 19, verse 9. "And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord Yahweh." Yeah, let me put it this way. This is who I am. This is my standard. This is what I believe is right. And I'm telling you that too. We have this statement, "I am the Lord," 16 times in this chapter. And it starts out with charity, gleaning, giving and sharing, doesn't it? Verse 11, "You shall not steal." Pretty clear. That's concrete, isn't it? The action of gleaning and allowing people to glean is concrete. Don't steal is concrete. Don't deal falsely is also concrete. Don't lie to one another, concrete. Why not? You don't want people to lie to you. You don't want people to steal from you. "You shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God." The Hebrew word God is Elohim, which means mighty or powerful one. And Moses was made Elohim in front of Pharaoh, who was Elohim. But God Almighty is the almighty powerful one over all. "You shall not defraud your neighbor nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until the morning." And you go to the book of Amos. He's known as the social prophet. And he says that this was the behavior. You took the cloak as a surety the person would do the work, and you didn't give it back to him, so he slept cold at night. Not very compassionate. Not very nice. Don't do that, he says. "You shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear or have in awe your God, because I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in judgment. We come to an abstraction. How do we judge? You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honour the person of mighty, because people can influence and buy their way out of trouble. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbour. What is it about God's law that is righteous that has to do with judgment? When we heard a couple of years back, council of elders are unethical. Really? Okay, as I said to one of my fellow elders, did you confront the individual or individuals? Did you bring witnesses? Did you take evidence? And did you do due process? The answer I got was silence. Justice is a process which we put people through. Justice is important. And oftentimes we transgress this in the Church of God simply because maybe we've not been made aware of it, but it's come home to me these last several years. We're not following God's way. Matthew 18, the whole chapter. And if you've got something against someone, go talk to them. Don't talk to the minister. Don't gossip behind their back. Do justice. Go talk to them. Try to work it out privately. Have the attitude of a little child. Confront them pleasantly. We often use the word confrontation in a negative sense. I don't mean that. Confront them humbly. And we have applied this in the Colorado Springs area. And one of my fellow elders here and another member here is sitting here who did that. And it worked out. We should do justice because God's laws are righteousness. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. Go help them. Don't tell tales. We have this wonderful tool called the internet, which is a gossip mongering machine. And people who call themselves Christians used it 2 years ago. To their shame, well, God's going to judge them, but frankly, if you don't know what gossiping is, then there's something wrong, something missing. But it was used effectively for gossip. Why don't we gossip? Because I'm God. I don't gossip. And I don't want you to gossip either, says the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear a grudge against the children of your people. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Why? Because I'm the Lord God, and this is what I believe you should do. These are my laws of righteousness. I believe all the way from 9 to 18 is what makes the difference between the Church of God in our behavior, with all of these objective criteria that were put there, all of these concrete behaviors, and makes a difference between someone else who is not called of God. I believe that's very important. And let us understand, the book of Leviticus was shortly after the Exodus from Egypt. And in a sermonette there, I noticed as he was mentioning about Joshua and Caleb, in one of the verses it said they pleaded, let's go back to Egypt. Let's go back. We don't want to go into this land. I said, are you kidding? I mean, if I look at my life, I wouldn't want to go back to where I was before I was called of God. Smoking my 50 cigarettes a day, swearing and cursing, gambling in the Royal Navy with people who had a sewerage orifice for a mouth, and so did I. I don't want to go back there. Been there, done that, learned differently. Have I made mistakes? Of course. But I don't want to go back there. Here they are, we're in the book of Leviticus. This was the beginning of how to treat your neighbour. And in the discussion here, we realise that they went out into the wilderness, they refused to go into the promised land, and so they wandered for another 38 years, a total of 40 since leaving Egypt. And did they love their neighbours? No. They couldn't do those things, you see. They had trouble doing those simplistic things that we read through verse 9 on all the way through. They had difficulty not gossiping. They had difficulty not lying. They had difficulty not defrauding. They had difficulty cheating. They had difficulty being just, applying God's concrete laws. They had difficulty with that. And so they went through the whole of the wandering of the wilderness, and the only two that went into the promised land were Joshua and Caleb, as our sermonette brought out. Joshua and Caleb, two out of how many people, I don't know. I've heard from 2 million to 6 million people who left Egypt. I don't know how you calculate that. Either number's big. So let's go to the second great commandment that Cicero, the unconverted Gentile, educated in the academy in Greece, reasoned. This was given nearly 40 years later when Moses basically said to the people, "This is my last hurrah. I'm about to die. And I'm going to give you Deuta, the second, Nomos, law, second giving of the law. I'm going to tell you what you already know. It's already in the scrolls. It's already in the Ark of the Covenant. It's already under the mercy seat. And you already know this, but I'm going to write it again. I'm going to tell you again." In chapter 6 and the first 6 verses. "Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you're going over to possess. You may fear the Lord your God and keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you and your son and your grandson all the days of your life, and the days that your days may be prolonged." Verse 4, here the word is Shema in Hebrew, which means not only hear, but by obvious reference, do. Hear and do. Hear and do. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. These are the words which I command you today to be in your heart." There's the emotional domain. The great social bond. If we love God and his laws, we will love our fellow man. Deuteronomy 7, verses 7 through 10. "The Lord did not set his love on you nor choose you because you were more in number than any other peoples, for you were the least of all peoples." Israel had nothing to be proud of. They were no different than the Gentiles around them. And God says, "You're the least. But I had to work with somebody, so I've chosen you," verse 6, "as a special treasure. I want to work with you people. But because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and brought you back, redeemed you, from the house of bondage and the land of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Therefore know that the Lord your God, he is the mighty, powerful one. He is the faithful, mighty, powerful one who keeps covenant and mercy for thousands of generations who love him and keep his commandments." How many people have heard something like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? That old harsh God of the Old Testament. Do you see that in this? You might check Exodus 33, where God and Moses have a conversation. The second giving of the tablets. "I'm a gracious, I'm a merciful, loving God." And Moses says, "Oh, we have received grace from you. Please don't put us away from among you." There is so much love in the Old Testament, if only we'd look at it and read it and see the intention God had. He goes on to say, who love him and keep his commandments. You see, keeping his commandments is love. And he repays those who hate him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will repay him to his face. Therefore you shall keep the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which I command you today to observe them. Then it shall come to pass, because you listen to these judgments and keep and do them, that the Lord your God will keep with you the covenant. The covenant. And the mercy which he swore to your fathers. He will love you and bless you and multiply you. And as I thought back on Mr. Swaggart's sermon yesterday of the terrible things we're doing to our planet, and I thought, you know, the answer to the planet is it needs healing. And if God created the Garden of Eden, he can re-heal this world. And we are going to have to go back and have a healing. And I won't take time there, but within this, he gives rain in due season. He makes stuff to grow. Whatever the stuff is, you like. You can tell Mr. Swaggart is a farmer, can't you? At heart. Right? You can tell. He loves the land. And so as you see here then, love God, and he will love you and take care of you. Hate God, and he will inflict justice on you, whether you like it or not. And oftentimes we are our own worst enemies. Chapter 10, verses 12 through 14. Once again, the essence of the law. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? Fear the Lord your God. Walk in all his ways. And to love him, to serve him, for the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. That, to me, sounds like a converted attitude that we need to have to do that. And to keep the commandment which the Lord and his statutes which I command you today for your good. For your good. I'm still struggling with this whole concept of the law being nailed to the cross and the law done away with. If this law is for our good, if this God gave the rules and regulations, if I can put it that way, the law, that we are to obey, and it is for our good. And if that God of the Old Testament, John chapter 1, verse 14, became flesh and dwelt among with us, and if that God was the Son of the Father, and he gave those laws, and then sacrificed himself because people broke those laws, makes sense to me that we ought to be obeying those laws. They're for our good. Why would he take them away and just say, oh, just love each other. We're under the dispensation of grace. So is ancient Israel, by the way. So is ancient Israel. And so are we now. But that doesn't take, you see, we take this love concept, and it's in the abstract. It doesn't take away the direct rules and regulations we should be obeying either. And he goes on to say it was for our good. Verse 14, indeed, the heavens, the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God, also the earth with all that is in it. The Lord delights only in your fathers to love them. And he chose them, their descendants after them, you above all peoples as it is this day. Therefore circumcise the foreskin of your heart. And as Abraham was physically circumcised, we're asked to check our attitudes of hard-heartedness. And don't be stiff-necked and stubborn or rebellious anymore. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords, a great and mighty and awesome. We need to use that word appropriately. I don't think any basketball player, any football player, any... can't think of the word. Baseball player, there you go. That hits it out of the park is awesome. And when sometimes people say, oh, that's awesome. I say, no, it's not. Only God is awesome. He is awesome. Not anything we human beings do is awesome. Only God. Only God. And as he goes on to say, circumcise your heart, don't be stiff-necked, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice. Justice. He's got his laws. He's got his processes. We ought to follow them. And it's justice for the fatherless and for the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. That's how generous this is. Therefore, love the stranger, for you were strangers in Egypt. We always ought to reflect back as to where we were when God called us. Where were we in life when God calls us? This is the great and mighty bond that we have. And we should have that love for the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow. And realize and understand that injustice is when we do not have that emotion towards them. Why? Because we were once strangers. God has called us out of bondage and slavery. And if this can be encapsulated in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when you think of our society at this time, can we identify with the fact that so many people are in ignorance? So many people are slaves to sin. As a nation that has something like 20% obesity rate, with type 2 diabetes skyrocketing, with heart attacks all over the place, with cancer and all the things that are taking place. And now obviously we can't stop everything, but we can do a lot for ourselves if we live healthy and we live good. But they're slaves to their appetite. They're slaves to gossiping. They're slaves to their iPhone 5s, if you will. They're slaves to stuff on the internet. Such a waste of time in so many ways. Now, believe me, as a teacher, I love the internet. You ever run up and down in a university in the stacks? That's where they keep the books. They call them the stacks. Trying to find this one and that one, and then you see some little nasty individual that's not very nice in life. They cut out the page you need. Let me get my hands on you, you little snotty thing. Been there, done that. Google is wonderful. So long as you put the right words in. So long as you put the right words in. We are no longer slaves to sin. So what do we do about the hurts and the pains? What do we do about the injustice that we all have received in life, one way or another? What do you do with all these injustices? The whole point about this is that we learn to live with injustice. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And the point of that is that we learn from the lessons of injustice how we ought to be in our approach towards one another, in our approach towards anyone out there in society. Why? Because God's law of love is combined in his commandments. Why? Because this compassion that we have, which is emotional, comes from within us, within our thinking, within the framework of God's law, and this is what we do. And you know what? That puts you at a disadvantage, ladies and gentlemen. You know why? Because people will know those are your values and standards that you're following of God. And they will attempt to take advantage of you when they know that you're a Christian, when they know that you won't lie, when they know that you won't cheat. And you're at a disadvantage. And you will be treated badly from time to time. So, I want to look for a moment, Genesis chapter 50, as we're coming down to the end of this story. Genesis chapter 50. If ever there's a wonderful story, and I put wonderful in quotes, of injustice, it was to poor old Joseph. Now let me ask you, how many of you, knowing the story of Joseph, he told his brothers, he's got his beautiful coat, and and I saw the stars, and I saw the wheat, and they all bowed down to me. How many people think that Joseph was a right snit? Hands up, please, tell me. If you really think, come on, put your hands up, be honest with it. How many of you ever thought from the other side of the fence wait a minute, maybe he was prophesying and God wanted him to say those things. We don't have a word in Scripture how Joseph really was. But did we reach a judgment? Yes, I did. And yes, you did, some of you. And for those people who didn't respond, you know what you thought. Yes, indeed. Well, let's realize the injustices done to Joseph. First of all, he was hated by his brothers. Almost put to death. Sold into slavery. Lost his family. As a slave, he was owned. He was goods and chattel. He was falsely accused by Potiphar's wife because he would not give in to her sexual advances. He was in prison for 13 years. 13 years. An innocent man. All through this time, we have no statement in any way, shape, or form that Joseph did anything wrong. In fact, his whole record, his whole life was that of doing things right despite. And we come down to the fact that terrible injustice was something that he had to live with for a very long time. He was always diligent in obedience to God's law. Brethren, one day Joseph woke up in prison. One morning he got up like he had the 13 previous years. One day it was just one more day to administer the prison, and he was trusted because of his character and integrity. And that afternoon, he was second in charge of Egypt. All that time, Joseph was suffering. All of those lessons he went through was for a reason and a purpose. All of us must learn. The trials of injustice, the unfairness, the inequity, the loss of job, the loss of money, whatever, the loss of relationship, we must understand that it is for a good reason. And there's one thing I want to ask you all to do in this matter, because we all carry our hurts and pains. The way that Joseph must have survived is like the way my good friend survived when they had a hurricane down in Houston. The roof was leaking. The house was a mess. And they were in upheaval for weeks because many homes were hurt several years ago when that hurricane hit Houston. And every day he and his wife would get up and say, "We've got to look at the progress we've made." Because everyone was demanding attention. Everyone wanted sheetrock. Everyone wanted their roofs re-roofed. Everyone. All of the industry that goes into building a house. And slowly but surely that house that was a mess, I know because I was in it, began to be built and painted and cleaned and renovated and brought back. And the only way they got through that was, "This too shall pass. We're making progress. It's coming to an end." In the case of Joseph, that's exactly what he did. And if you look at verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for the evil which we did to him." Well, isn't that what you expect, carnally speaking? Humanly speaking, "I'm going to get you back." Boom! "Get away from my microphone." Little bit of carnality there from that little darling. "Get back. It's not your microphone, it's mine too." Oh, I love the kids' choir. I love the young gentleman with long sleeves too. You know, there were no hands, just white cuffs. That was just precious. All right. You expect to be prayed evil from in this world. So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, whether or not this was true, I don't know. Before your father died, he commanded, saying, thus you do say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin. For they did evil to you. And the word for evil is ra'ah, which means evil. Evil. Now please forgive their trespass of the servants of the God of your fathers. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Why did Joseph cry? Why did he weep? He could do that because he could have compassion. He could do that because he had forgiven them already. He could do that because he learned from the injustice of all those years in prison, all of those false accusations, all of being sold, etc. All of this encapsulated in an overall lesson for him. Then his brothers went and fell down before his face, indeed, as Joseph had prophesied. And behold, they said, we are your servants. Then Joseph said to them, do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? You see, brethren, it's not our job to try to right injustice. It's not our responsibility. It's God's. I will repay, Paul writes in the book of Romans. I will take vengeance, says God. We don't need to do that. That's emotionally what we want to do a lot of the times, isn't it? And when we do that, we break the principles of God's law. When we allow those emotions to come forward. Verse 20. But as for you, you meant evil against me. And now this wonderful, wonderful statement. But God meant it for good. All of these lessons were for my benefit. All of these lessons were for my help. All of these lessons was to save this family alive so that you could come down to Egypt and I could give you food and protect you and look after you as well as all of the Egyptians. God meant it for good in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. Now, therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. What a wonderful attitude. Are we in a forgiving, loving attitude? Do we think positively about all of the lessons that we learned? If I had a mirror, I would do this at this moment. A lot of people go through life looking in the rearview mirror. A lot of people go through life carrying burdens, heavy burdens, because emotionally they will not release themselves from it. The only way to get rid of those emotional burdens is to look to the future, like Joseph did. Look for the learning in the lessons and the circumstances that come your way, because, brethren, so often we learn how not to do something by what we suffer doing it, or what people do to us and we suffer in the doing. That's how we learn. That's how we grow, and that's how we understand. So look forward to the teaching. We're here to learn these lessons. We're here to become teachers. We're here to live the image of a wonderful world tomorrow. We're here to prepare for a great and innumerable multitude of people that are going to be resurrected at the end of the millennium. How do you mentor? How do you teach? One of the great mistakes I think the Church of God has made in approach is we have told, but we haven't taught. And we need to discuss the sermons. We need to come up, as a young couple came to me and said, oh, Shutu, wasn't it? Came up to me and said, what do you mean by this? Oh, great. I didn't make it clear. Let's talk about this. Let's understand what we mean. I have no objection with anyone coming up and doing this. And we do this in the Springs and in Denver as much as we can. And Mr. Scott Ashley is going through the Harmony of the Gospels in the New King James Version. And we talk in there. And it's great. He doesn't always get through as much as he should. But, but you see, it's a wrong criteria to say, I've got to get from A to B. Are you getting knowledge and are you getting understanding from your congregation along the way? I don't care if you don't get to B, so long as you get understanding and knowledge and comprehension in A. So let us appropriately challenge our elders if we don't understand something. Say, hey, can we talk about this? Let us go up and ask questions. Let us have discussions after church, after the formal services has gone on. And understand, because we all see things slightly differently. We've got left brain people here, we've got right brain people here, we've got some more right brain than left brain people, and my strengths or weaknesses may not be yours. You may visualize something completely differently. And that's wonderful. God gave us these minds and differences and talents, but we merge and blend them together in harmony by obedience to God's law, by thinking along the ways that he has us to think, and by applying the lessons of life we call injustice. So look forward and remember our purpose here is quite simply this: to learn the lessons of life and the injustice, to know what the principles of injustice are and how we apply God's law with love and kindness and compassion.